Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Glad you're listening to NPR News today. Years ago, when Michelle Norris's race card project was still pretty new, she came to the Guthrie Theater here in her hometown, and during the evening, she asked the audience if they would accept a challenge. Write down the first six words that came to mind when Michelle said the word race. Now, I remember how people stood up that night and read their six words to the hushed and guarded and, let's be honest, some uncomfortable space in that room. And they're still writing and sharing those words. In a new article that Michelle wrote for National Geographic magazine, she says, "I had no idea that what I was actually creating was a taproot that would carry me into people's most private spaces, to towns I'd never heard of, countries I'd never visited, and cultures that were both foreign and familiar. I had no idea there were so many people who were so eager to talk about race and identity that they would share their thoughts with a stranger, knowing that their stories could be posted on a website for anyone to see." So what is it about that card and those six words, an additional question, and Michelle's generous listening that has created a deluge of candid reflections on race? As Michelle joins us, I wonder if you can participate in this morning. Six words that say something about your own experience and your own perceptions of race. Six words that say something about what Michelle calls the power, rejection, belonging, and fear associated with race. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, anywhere in the Midwest, and you can tweet in at Carrie NPR. Michelle Norris is a journalist, writer, founder of the Race Card Project. Her article appears in National Geographic, and she joins us from the Twin Cities. And Michelle, back in your old hometown, and welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Carrie, it's great to be with you again.
You write in your article, through this work, we get to see people as they see themselves. And it's clear that your own perceptions and your own expectations went through an evolution since you began. And I'd love to have you reflect on that to start.
Well, Carrie, I'm so glad you started where this all started. I so vividly remember the evening at the Guthrie Theater. And I was terrified that night when you asked the audience.
Were you?
I was, because you asked the audience, and I was like, what if no one stands up? Okay, Carrie's an expert interviewer. We'll just keep rolling with this. And you remember that, you know, first there was the woman that was off to the right who talked about growing up and having, you know, one person who befriended her in the classroom, and then a man stood up and talked about what it was like to be a large black man. And it felt like a town hall, but with a level of intimacy that really shocked me at that time, because I wasn't sure what to expect. So, you know, I created, and I said this in the article, and I've said it many times, I created this project based on a false premise, something that I now understand was a mistaken notion, that the idea that no one wants to talk about race. Actually, a lot of people are just trying to figure out how to merge into that conversation and how to do it in a place where they won't face opprobrium or they won't face judgment or where they will just be heard. And after collecting, you know, after archiving more than 500,000 stories and having thousands more that are still waiting to be officially archived, we now know that a lot of people actually are trying to figure this out and are looking for a place to do that. And they don't turn to their spouse, their coworker, their best friend. They are looking for a space where they can think out loud. And thankfully, this crazy project started in the third floor of my house has become that for a lot of people. And it's allowed me as a journalist to understand the nuances and the complexities and the intimacies around race and identity. And I often talk about race and identity because so many of the cards, Carrie, that come in don't speak to race as we traditionally think about it in terms of the box you check or your skin color. They're sometimes about the condition that you live in. I'm a vet. I have red hair. I am economically disadvantaged. I am disabled in some way. People write about their own identity frame. And as you say, they do it on their own terms. And so they're not setting, we're not setting the agenda for this conversation. They are.
What I think is genius about this is that you really went against conventional wisdom, because I think had you been talking to people, what do you think about this idea? You might have heard, are you kidding? Boil down the idea of race and identity into 6 words. Well, what is it then about the creation and the rhythm of those 6 words that makes this work?
You know, it's in part because we're used to 6-word exercises. It's a common theme. There are all kinds of 6-word exercises. It is partially because of the patois and the rhythm of 6 words. There's something, if you listen to music, I know when I write, I talk out loud. I'm often tapping my toe or my hand on the desk like a metronome. There is something about the poetic nature of putting together 6 words, but I think it's also that it's simple. It's not a whole paragraph, so we're not asking a lot. It's not even a whole sentence. It's sort of not really a haiku. That's the wrong term. Our poets would say, wag their fingers at me, say, stop calling this a haiku. But there is something poetic about it, and it really does distill your thoughts down to the thing that's most important. And I think the other reason that this worked, Carrie, is that there's modeling going on, because at the beginning, so many of the stories that came in were surface level. I'm not saying they weren't interesting, but they were just sort of riding on the surface. And then when people started sending in cards that got much deeper, too black for black men's love, I'm only Asian when it's convenient, white, not allowed to be proud, black babies cost less to adopt, my mother hated my dark skin. It was almost as if people were reading these on the website, because we did put them out in the world, and we created a series of shows when I was still at National Public Radio on Morning Edition. And the more people heard those stories, they understood the rules of engagement. Oh, we're going there? Oh, okay, well, let me tell you what I really think. And then when we asked people to share with us the backstory behind their 6 words, that's when things started to really get interesting, because not only were they sharing their 6 words, but they were explaining why they chose those 6 words, or they were explaining the situation that happened to them in the military, in childhood, with their neighbor, at the grocery store, on the plane, that led them to share those 6 words. And that's when it really became, you know, you use the word taproot. Mm-hmm. That's when I was really able to understand, wow, we have really opened up a crevice that is allowing us to see and hear and understand things that would not be available to us, because this is not the kind of thing that people talk about. I invite people, if they go to the website at theracecarproject.com, to read the stories out loud and put your mouth around someone else's truth, but also understand that what you're seeing there, you don't hear people say out loud. Not even at the dinner table, you know, when you're with your besties or your family. And so it really is this space of candor. And instead of turning people off, it is more like a beckoning finger. Come on, there's a seat for you at the table, too.
Call from Tony in Minneapolis. Hi, Tony. I'm really glad you called.
Hi. Good morning.
What'd you want to say?
Well, my 6 words, I thought about this when she first came out with this. I'm from South Minneapolis, 65 years old. Grew up on 44th and 3rd Avenue South. And mm-hmm. the time in that neighborhood where there weren't very many black people in the neighborhoods. One summer, I was about 9 years old, and I'm playing with this neighborhood kid across the alley. And we had a great summer, doing a lot of things all summer long. One day he says to me at the end of the day, Tony, you're my best colored friend. And it hit me. I didn't have the words at that age to articulate what I was feeling. But I got to tell you, for the rest of my life, I'm 65 now, it still bothers me to this day.
I can hear that. in your voice.
Yeah, it's and you know, Minneapolis is not heavily populated with African Americans, but so I've learned how to interact with other races, but that one got me. And I've noticed that, you know, all my life that same sentiment seems to be prevalent amongst Euro-Americans in this city. We can be the best friend, but we're still denoted as a race.
Michelle, you mentioned how many of these stories, like Tony's, come out of childhood.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, searing interactions. And Tony, thank you. Thanks very much for calling to share it. Tony tells us he's 65. It happened when he was 9. There's a scar. And it sounds like a lot of people delve back into their childhoods to retrieve experiences like this to share.
A lot of people do carry reach back to the past. And many times it is childhood. Maybe they're still adjudicating something that happened to them years ago. And Tony, thank you so much for sending in your story. I grew up not far from you, 4800 block of Oakland, so I know the neighborhood well, and I know what was going on in that area at that time. That was an area that was going through, it was newly integrating. Black families were moving into a space that was not imagined for them, because many of the homes in that neighborhood had restricted covenants that would prevent Black families from moving in. So his story speaks to me. And it's interesting because this is the complexity of race. People often say that they want to be seen and acknowledged, but not necessarily boxed in and with some sort of asterisk. So they are the best at what they do as a Black person, not just the best. You know, at a young age, you're looking for a best friend. Everyone wants to have that best friend, right? And what it sounds like he heard was, well, you're my best friend in that category, but not necessarily mm-hmm. my best friend. And as a kid, that probably hurt, and it probably was contextualized by all kinds of other things that were happening that were reminding him that there was a discount being applied to him in some way in a culture that had, you know, I was going to say that did not yet value Black people or Black lives. We're still sort of struggling with that. So what you're hearing there, but as a journalist and as someone who's been working on this project for a long time, I feel like I could do a whole series of reunion conversations because there's this Rashomon effect to this. You know, like I would love to find that child who lived across the alley and put the two of them together. And and I would bet, because I've done some of this, that in some cases his interpretation of the events would be completely different. He may have said, gosh, I was trying to acknowledge that I had a Black friend. I was just trying to say, I see you. I don't know that that's mm-hmm. the case, but I think that when you bring people together and you allow them to talk in some way, you're surprised. And you're also surprised by two people who experience the same thing. And we have this in our families. We sit at the same dinner table and you walk away and you heard a different conversation than I heard, right? Because mm-hmm. you filtered it through your own experiences. So you know, it's part of the work. It doesn't stop with the six words. We're always going in and doing oral histories and interviews with the people who send us their stories. And as I listen to Tony's, I really would like to hear from that other child who's now probably in his 60s too.
I know, and I wondered as Tony was describing that, if his white friend has, well, thought about it, maybe remembers it with some kind of pride. I played with a Black child. He was my best friend. I didn't really know, you know, how what I said was going to be heard. Yeah, love your idea of the reunion. From Christine on Twitter, my six words, integrated all Black school, Mississippi, 1968. She says, it was my first year as a teacher, and my husband and I were stationed at the Naval Air Station in Meridian, Mississippi. Federal regulations required schools to be integrated. I was the first white person at G.W. Carver Junior High. Do you hear, Michelle, from a number of people who have had that first experience? And it shapes, really informs the rest of their lives.
Well, I would love to sit down and talk to Christine, because that had to have been all kinds of interesting. You know, you had me with first to integrate an all-black school, then you add Meridian, Mississippi, and then you add 1968, and then you add military base. I mean, every vellum layer that she added there makes the story much more interesting. And yes, we do hear a lot of this. And, you know, if you think about what was going on with integration, we take it for granted now. When you go to a sporting event, when you go to a shopping mall, when you walk down the street, you know, you see integration is all around us. I am old enough to remember a moment where that didn't happen. You know, my family is from the South. My father is from Birmingham, Alabama. Life in Minnesota was very different from Birmingham, so I still remember a very stark and distinct color line. And as that was falling away, there were an army of young people, because the place where this was happening, under court order, as she mentioned, or under, mm-hmm. you know, some sort of legislation, but usually court order, were in schools. And so there were a generation of people. We know about Ruby Bridges, and we know about Vivian Malone at the University of Alabama, and we know about James Meredith at the University of Mississippi. But there were a generation of children who experienced integration of some kind in the classroom. In college, you know, you went to school, you'd never seen a black person, all of a sudden you have a black roommate. A teacher in a white teacher in an all-black school, her experiences have had to been interesting and maybe on some level terrifying for her, depending on how much exposure she had to integration. Enlightening in all kinds of ways. And I would love to know how she carried that experience forward. Did she stay in teaching? You know, what did she see? What she's describing is unusual, because usually the kids were the ones who were shipped around, right? Mm-hmm. So in her case, a teacher being mm-hmm. sent to an all-black school is a little bit unusual. And I mentioned the military base, because the military bases were integrated ahead of the general society. And so, you know, I wonder what role that may have played at G.W. Carver Junior High. I'd love to hear more about her story. But yes, a lot of those cards do.
I've retweeted Michelle, so you can reach out to her okay. via Twitter. Hopefully Christine is still listening. If you've just tuned in, conversation here with Michelle Norris about the trajectory of her race card project. We talked at the beginning a bit about being together at the Guthrie years ago when Michelle was just launching it and asking people to reflect in six words on the ideas and the perceptions and the experiences of race and identity. Well, over the years, the project has really bloomed, and she's done a lot of listening and absorbing of stories. And we're talking about what she's learned. She's got a new article in National Geographic magazine that I spotted. I thought, hey, this is a great opportunity to come back to this. And so to listen to this conversation, all good. If you'd like to participate, love to have you do that as well. On Twitter, six words that reflect your own perception of race and identity. And it's at Kerry, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Michelle Norris is also there. I've retweeted her. But if you're of a mind to call in, I think we'd love to hear that too. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. From Hope on Twitter, I am but a passing figure, my why. Though I'd love to dive into the Vietnamese heritage of my mother's side, I am white passing, and I have felt ousted from those groups thusly. Oh my gosh, this gives me a sense, Michelle. Every one of these is like a gut punch.
Yeah, and wow. A novel almost, right?
I know. What do you hear in that?
Well, you know, I hear someone who is longing to learn more about her heritage. I wonder, you know, what white passing means for her, and is it something that she decided assiduously to do at some point? You know, there are a lot of stories that I hear about passing, and one of the things that I realize in talking to people who are passing, and passing on all kinds of levels, black people who are passing as white, Latino people who are passing as white or as a different kind of Latino, because that happens to be easier in the part of the world that they're in, right? There are more Puerto Ricans here than Mexicans, or more Dominicans here than Hondurans. Jews who are passing as Christians, you know, passing of all kinds, right? But it doesn't often happen where someone wakes up in the morning and says, I'm gonna decide to be something else. It often just happens almost adrift. Someone mistakes them and then they just never correct them. They realize in a spur of the minute they're applying for something, a job, a mortgage. I'm going to be advantaged if I say I'm this. And then once you cross that, you know, what you gain, there's this tension between what you gain and what you leave behind, and whether you really ever do leave it behind, you know, how it still is roiling inside you in some way. And, you know, and it also makes me think about, you know, when we talk about race, Carrie, we often are talking about people of color and often black people. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's changed over the time that I've been collecting these stories is a real examination of whiteness in America, and whiteness being part of the conversation, because often whiteness in America was the cultural default, and everything else was the thing that was otherized or in some cases problematized. And when people are passing, they're often passing into whiteness, sometimes other things, like I said, Christianity or other, you know, ethnicities, but it's often into whiteness. And it also, after collecting these stories over time, it also has really made me think about the expansion of whiteness, and how that may shift over time. I think we're going to see it probably shift in our census categories, as we've seen in the past. You know, people have moved into white culture usually in aspirational ways because they want to be a part of the majority culture, and there are advantages to being part of the majority culture. But the majority culture has also absorbed other groups to hold on to its majority over time. You know, many people who came to this country who were not considered white over time became white.
As immigrants, you mean?
Yes, yeah. Yes. And so there's, you know, that has been one of the more interesting aspects of this work is the to see the country really examining whiteness and what it means to be white, and white people stepping into a conversation about race that has usually been by, for, and about people of color. If you spend time on the website, you see that a lot of the people who send in their stories are white Americans or white people from all over the world, because we should say we have cards that come from more than 107 countries. And that is interesting, because that is not, you know, traditionally when we've had conversations about race, often white people, whether they want to be or not, have been given some sort of bystander status. And that's changed for the project, but on the whole, I think that's changed for the country.
And it needs to have changed, right? Call here from Ari in Minneapolis. Hi, Ari. So glad you called.
Hello.
Hi.
My story, let me get it. I actually wrote it down. Junior varsity soccer team, bus floor.
Tell us.
So that story comes from a time in my life. I was a junior in high school on the soccer team, and we took a trip to a soccer game more in a more rural area. And I remember seeing cornfields and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, my soccer coach yelled at Ari, get on the floor. And it was just really loud and scary. And I could tell his voice was, you know, very serious. Mm-hmm. And then later I find out we actually drove through a KKK rally. And this is 2002. Just want to let you know that. In a rural town, and I'm black. There was one other black girl on the team. Everybody else was white. But yeah, I'll never forget that because, A, that was less than 20 years ago. B, it was just terrifying. And, you know, that safe space of a school bus in school was definitely not safe, you know, that day. And that's my story.
Did you ever talk with Oh, yeah. You didn't tell us that, Ari. Where was that?
I'm originally from Indiana, so that was actually a small town, Indiana, Marion, Indiana. We were headed to, I think, Elwood, which is, yeah, I believe that's where that was.
In 2002. So did you ever talk to the coach or, I don't know, some of the other students about it? Or was this happened, I'm living with it, it was my own experience?
I don't remember. You know, I think we kind of got there and we didn't really talk about it too much and we played the game. And I don't really remember past that much discussion. But when this came up today, I think after the show, I'm going to message that the other soccer player and see what she thinks, if she remembers that.
There's a reunion story for you, Michelle, right there.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I want to be on the bus, and I want to hear the coach, and I want to hear the other soccer players. And I love when these stories are catalytic. Ari, I hope you do reach out and talk to other people, because I'm hoping that – I call this the Race Card Project because I hate that term, and it's usually used to shut down conversation. I was trying to turn it on its head and use this as a way to stoke conversation, and so I hope that – that you will continue this. You know, Indiana has a long and somewhat notorious history with the Klan throughout the state. Active, very active in the 1920s, still active today. There were many so-called sundown towns, a term that some may or may not be familiar with, but the idea that if you were a person of color, you had better get out of town before the sun sets because bad things might happen to you. And the idea when you told the story, Carrie, were you thinking that she had to have been talking about something that happened?
1968.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I had no idea how old you were from talking, but that it happened 20 years ago. And that today we're still talking about, you know, the Klan is in the news right now because the state of Texas has changed its curriculum so that children will no longer learn, as they have in the curriculum over decades, that the Ku Klux Klan was a morally reprehensible organization fueled by hate. And they have decided to take that out of the curriculum along with the teachings of Cesar Chavez and Martin Luther King and suffragettes like Susan B. Anthony. So, you know, this history, first of all, is not necessarily ancient history, right? It's mm-hmm. it's still in our present, and we are still struggling as a nation with how to address the history. And I watch what's going on with the discussion about how to teach race in American schools, and it's so interesting to me because it's clear from so many of the stories that I receive that people are trying to figure out how to talk about this and are trying to figure out how to reconcile with this and are trying to figure out how to deal with the discomfort that it makes them feel. And it's you know, an interesting notion that for people who are uncomfortable with these kinds of this history and acknowledging it and teaching it to children and talking about it as, you know, part of American history and the notion that race has shaped almost every aspect of American life, but yet trying to run away from that is almost like trying to run away from the sky.
No,
you
so
know,
true.
How do you get out from under it? Because it's so much a part of our history. And I you know, I obviously have a different view. Why would you want to get out from under it? Why not examine it? Because it is a part of our life.
Ari, I'm so glad you heard the show and you had a chance to call in. If you are waiting on the phones, please hang with us. We're going to get a look at the latest news. When we come back, more of your calls and your stories. And I want to say that Michelle opens the piece in National Geographic with this beautiful photograph and I've thought about this story constantly since I read the article, the story of Kelly Stewart Johnson of Brooklyn. So we'll talk about that too. On the other side of news. To join in, 651-227-6000, tweet in at Carrie NPR, to Phil Picardi now with the latest. Hi, Phil.
Good morning, Carrie. The number of Americans seeking unemployment benefits actually rose last week. Jobless claims increased to 419,000 from 368,000 the previous week. The Biden administration says it is making $3 billion in economic development grants available to communities. That's a tenfold increase in the program paid for by this year's COVID-19 relief bill. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo says officials hope the money will create hundreds of thousands of jobs. She says the goal is to help struggling cities and towns make long-term investments to drive development. The Justice Department is launching gun trafficking strike forces in five cities. They are part of an effort to reduce violent crime by addressing illegal trafficking and prosecuting offenses that help put guns in the hands of criminals. Attorney General Merrick Garland is launching the strike forces in Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is rejecting two Republicans tapped by House GOP leader Kevin McCarthy to sit on a Commerce committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection. McCarthy denounced the decision as an egregious abuse of power and said the GOP will not participate in the investigation if Democrats won't accept the members he appointed. Pelosi called the integrity of the probe into question in refusing to accept the appointments. The appointees are both outspoken allies of former President Donald Trump. And a judge says victims and families who suffered losses in the collapse of a 12-story oceanfront Florida condominium will get a minimum of $150 million in compensation. The judge says the sum includes insurance on the Champlain Tower South building and the expected proceeds from the sale of the Surfside property. It does not include proceeds from the many lawsuits that have been filed since the June collapse that left at least 97 people dead. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:37.
Record heat in the West, record cold in the South, and catastrophic flooding in between. The UN says that's what happens when humanity wages war on nature.
This is suicidal.
What are we doing about it? And are we doing enough?
Nature always strikes back, and it is already doing so with growing force and fury.
Next time on 1A. 1A starts at 10 a.m. here on NPR News.
At 11, more Americans reported feeling lonely during the pandemic, especially older adults. What's causing this, and how should we respond? At 11.
On the podcast right now, our conversation yesterday about the Delta variant, understanding how it spreads, why it's so transmissible, where you should be masking, how you should handle interactions with family and friends who are not vaccinated. Find it on the podcast. Search NPR News with Carrie Miller. Wherever you get your podcast tomorrow at 9 a.m., the next time you whip out a credit card to buy something, ask yourself this. Do I need it? Do I really need it? Will it make my life measurably better? The minimalists have an answer for that. And they're here tomorrow morning at 9. Listen in.
Environmental Reporting is supported by All Energy Solar, offering virtual summer solar webinar series to learn more about the benefits of solar at your convenience. You can choose from various virtual July through August sessions. More at allenergysolar.com.
Back to the conversation now with Michelle Norris. As noted, she has written about the Race Card Project and its trajectory since she started it. In National Geographic magazine, so you can catch that article. I want to go right back to the phones here to Christine in College Grove. Oh, Christine from Twitter. You've called in.
Yes.
Good.
Hi, thank
I'm
you
so
much.
Glad.
It's an honor to talk with Ms. Norris.
Thank Tell you us a little more about your story.
In. Well, as I said, it was my first year of teaching. My husband was a naval aviator. A Marine pilot stationed at Meridian, Mississippi. And at that time, you interviewed for a job with the superintendent. And the superintendent asked me, quote, would you find it objectionable to teach in a situation in which you are in the racial minority? And I said, that's fine. And he said, we have a position for you at George Washington Carver Junior High School. And then he had a long pause, and he looked at me, and he said, "It's air conditioned." And so I taught there. It was a life-changing experience. I had read about things, but I had no idea what it was like for a black person in the South. I was on the women's softball team at the base. And I do want to make sure people understand this was a public school. This was not a school on the base. Mm-hmm. And I was on the women's softball team, and we had to disband because we had black women on the team and no teams in town would play us. And the Little League team, which, as you both know, in 1968 would be all boys, had a similar experience. But fortunately for the boys, there were two Little League teams on the, from the base. And so they essentially played each other the whole season. When there was a party, kind of a parent association party at the Holiday Inn or something like that, the principal asked me to come into the office, and he asked if my husband and I were going to the party that was upcoming. And I said, "Oh, yes, of course, we're looking forward to it." And he said, "I'd like to invite you and your husband to bring some other couples from the base." And the implication was kind of clear. And so we gathered for some appetizers at our apartment beforehand. And it was decided that my husband, who does not drink, and everyone knew he didn't drink, that he would drive all six of us because at that time in Mississippi, it was just the officer's word that you were intoxicated. And we were all somewhat concerned that our being at an all-black gathering, the authorities might follow us as we drove away. Wow. It was very eye-opening. One of my students, Caroline Blanks, was accepted into a Better Chance program. And as luck would have it, she was here at Carleton in the summer of 1969 preparing to enter that program. And my husband and I had just moved here in the early August of 1969 here to Minnesota. And Caroline was at Carleton, and she and I had stayed in touch. So I drove to see her. And I did try in my 40 years of teaching to tell all of my classes about this experience, to tell them that this was not ancient history, and to try to bring home to them what other Americans had gone through.
What a singular, was it just a year, Christine, in your 40 years?
It was
years
just
of teaching?
A year. My husband had only the one more year left on active duty. And so it was just the year. I did find out that, that what was typically done was that spouses from the base, and again, you'll both understand that in 1968, the aviators and the mechanics, who were mainly the people at the base and admin people, were all male. So the spouses were female, and the spouses who were teachers were typically offered a position at an all-black school. And so I joined the Black Teachers Union. You know, I taught at the all-black school. Why not? They were my colleagues.
I'll tell you something, Christine. To hear that this was a year, but that this is the singular experience that came to mind when, you know, Michelle asked for these six words is just profound.
It was a very life-changing experience. I was born and raised in New Jersey, went to college in New York. It was life-changing.
Christine, thank you so much for telling this story. Carrie, it underscores something that we've learned, and this is why, you know, we're working on a podcast and a book about this, and we feel the team, the tiny, mighty team that works on this project, we feel like we can't let it go because every one of these stories is a portal.
I know.
So, you know, Christine is telling her singular story at George Washington Carver High School, or Junior High, but she's inviting us to think about what was going on in 1968. And, you know, that was a tumultuous year in terms of integration. There was the beginning of what they called segregation academies throughout the South, where white families were pulling out of public schools rather than integrate and creating Christian academies, schools that still exist all throughout, not just the South, but really throughout America, which became alternative educational spaces for students who didn't want to integrate. What was going on in bases where, you know, the military became integrated thanks to Harry Truman in the 1940s. But look what was happening still in the 1960s, you know, in places like Mississippi. So every one of these stories is like a window into this great big house, you know, we all live in. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate Christine sharing that rich story.
I'm so glad you're working on a podcast. Wow. To hear these voices, that's powerful. I just want you to briefly, because I do want to go back to some calls here, but will you just tell, for listeners who haven't seen the article yet, the story of Kelly Stewart Johnson of Brooklyn, New York? It opens the Nat Geo piece, and boy, it's a gut punch of a story.
Well, it starts with, he's my dad, not the gardener, are the six words. And it starts with a situation that most of us can imagine back in the days when we were working in an office. Remember that? Before the pandemic? And someone sees a picture, and someone pointed to a picture of her childhood home and asked whether the person that she saw in the picture was a black man who was pulling weeds. Was that the gardener? And she says she was so angry at the assumption because the person in the picture, Alfred Brown Jr., the man they called Junie, was her father. And Kelly Stewart is a white woman with blonde hair, and her father is a black man with dark skin and graying hair at that point in his life. Kelly's biological father is white. Her mother and her biological father split up when she was very young, and her mother remarried a black man. And she has spent, you know, a lifetime watching people react to them in interesting ways because, again, this was years ago. And, you know, we now see integrated families, multiracial families all over the place. You turn on the TV, you see them. But, you know, this was at a time when it was still newer in America. And he is her stepfather, a term she doesn't like because she claims him as her father. And he was such an important influence in her life. And the assumptions that someone made about him really bothered her because she realized that that's often what people would see when they saw Alfred Brown, and he was so much more than that and had so much to offer the world, but also that people were unable to understand what he meant to her. And it's interesting that she has now, you know, spent her life really trying to figure out how to have these really difficult conversations in her workplace, in her job, in her school, in her, you know, apartment in Brooklyn, because she said opening, being able to share her six words, and she sent her six words in, you know, years ago. I was still at NPR when she sent those in.
Oh, wow.
Has really opened up a space for her, and we hear that over and over again from people who share their story. Like it just opens a floodgate, and they exhale, and they're able to sometimes have those kind of conversations publicly, but often, you know, like you heard Ari, okay, I want to reach back to my former classmates. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to finally talk to my grandmother about this. You know, another Kristen Moorhead, another woman that was in the article, sent in six words, "I wish he was a girl," talking about her son after watching the killing of Tamir Rice, who was 13, at the time when her son was 13. And I went back and interviewed both of them, and you've heard of the talk, the idea that parents have this talk with their children, usually black or brown parents trying to help their children learn how to comport themselves in the world if they encounter police, if they're accused of something, if they're seen as less than, if they have to figure out how to hold on to their dignity or their pride or their safety as they're moving about the world. Well, in this case, when Kristen, when I interviewed her about why she said that, and of course she didn't really want a girl. She's so thankful for her son, Che, but she was just so worried about him in a world where she was seeing all this, these incidents of violent encounters with young black men and police. And he wound up giving her the talk. Okay, Mom, this is what I've learned. This is how I comport myself. This is what I do when I walk down the street. This is how I say hello to someone so they hear my voice. Or, you know, I make sure when I walk in a store, I look them in the eye, and he still has kind of a squeaky, you know, middle school voice a little bit now, and it's actually deepened over the summer. And he says he wants them to hear that and hear the way he speaks, because he's very learned, as a way to protect himself. And Christian said that was so heartbreaking to her, because she was on one hand glad that he took the lesson and learned it, but inside she was so angry that she had to even teach him that lesson. So job well done, but heartbreak that she even had to, that was the world that she had to prepare him for.
Call from Nancy in Minneapolis. Hi, Nancy. Thank you for waiting.
Oh, you're welcome. Nice to be here. Michelle, I read your book. I live on 15th Avenue, on 48th, between 47th and 48th, and on the end of the block is a Black Baptist church. It used to be the Epiphany Lutheran Church in 1926. And during the George Floyd issues that we had, our neighborhood was, you know, on alert. We had cameras going. We had watches going around the clock. Get your hose out. Get your stuff in. And to our surprise, and no one is Black in the neighborhood, is signs were made, huge signs painted that says the neighbors are watching, and posted them all around the church. And it's like we didn't even know that we lived with neighbors who out of nowhere were going to protect this Black church. And I walked down the street one day, and one of the maintenance guys was out, and I said, I just read this book. Have you ever read this book? Do you know who Michelle Norris is? She grew up right down here. And it started the conversation. They have a large garden, and the only food shelf in this part of Minneapolis. And so we decided, we had a greenhouse that we hadn't set up because the pandemic got in the way. We donated the greenhouse to the church, which already had.
Nancy, we lost the call, but I think Michelle heard. Nancy, are you there? Ah, I think that call might have dropped, Michelle, but I think you have most of the story there.
Well, a neighborhood I know very well that was somewhat east of where I grew up, but know that area well. Did not know about Epiphany Lutheran Church, but love the idea that people who had no connection to the church rose up and decided to protect them and created a cocoon around that church, and hopefully a cocoon within the neighborhood that will outlast, what did she say, the situation with George Floyd? I think it's such an interesting way to describe that. As the city continues to deal with this, you know, this is a scar that will remain for decades and maybe even centuries. And we focused on the division and the destruction and the trial. But, you know, in every one of these instances, as you look at the more granular stories, there are connections and also conundrums, you know, that sometimes happen. But what I really love in hearing that story is that that spontaneously, without anyone telling them that they needed to do it, that, you know, far outside of the eye of the news, because the international eye was on Minneapolis for months and kind of still is, that there were things like that happening that will go a long way toward, hopefully, I don't know that wound will be easily mended, but will help provide some sort of balm for a city that is still very fractured and really hurting and, you know, and still trying to figure out what do you do to that space at 38th in Chicago.
You know what? I've wondered if the city of Minneapolis could write six words, what would they be? Be an interesting exercise, wouldn't it?
I mean, the city should do it. It would be a way to actually, it would be an interesting thing to do because you would catalog people's memories, feelings, observations, perspectives in this year of tumult. And, you know, when we work with institutional partners, that's often what we're doing is excavating stories for posterity so people can better understand, so people can actually listen to each other. Because, you know, if you pick at that, I keep calling it a wound, but if you pick at it, you know, no, we don't all agree. You know, there are some people who feel that the unrest was unnecessary. There are some people who feel that the unrest was the voice of the people who have been ignored for too long. And for all kinds of reasons, it's much harder to get people to listen to each other. You know, people just, we live a more siloed existence. We live in, you know, parallel lanes. Even, you know, we're both in the news media. We understand this because of the news diet that people consume. They often listen to, read, or watch news that confirms or affirms everything that they already believe. And never, you know, meeting a person or a perspective that might counter their own. And this is the Race Car Project is a place where you will do that. I guarantee you. If you go to the website, you will nod your head in affirmation with some of the things that you read. But you will also be made uncomfortable, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. Because if we're going to make any kind of progress, we have to get used to being more comfortable with being uncomfortable.
I want to share just a couple more submissions here that showed up in the article from Daniel in Seattle. Ashamed that accomplished minorities surprise me. And Celeste Green of Chapel Hill, North Carolina. We aren't all strong black women. She's taken that into her medical training and her medical practice. Michelle, thank you as always. You're generous with your time and it's much appreciated. Thank you.
Carrie, I always love talking to you. Thanks so much.
Check out Michelle Norris's project, The Race Card Project, online. And if you have stories, you can see her Twitter account on my Twitter account and submit to The Race Card Project.
NPR News with Carrie Miller is produced by Kelly Gordon and Ariana Rosas. You can hear the show live at 9 a.m. weekdays on NPR News or by subscribing to the NPR News with Carrie Miller podcast.